one, but can add it in a second.
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order April 4th, 2011. We're going to, just for those of you that might be here for 3394, that bill will not be heard today. In fact, it may not be heard any day. So you might say it's slowly dying.
I can't say that. It didn't reach the priority.
And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3068. Staff?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3068 makes modification to ORS 138.060. This section has to do with what courts may take an appeal. Presently, the state may take an appeal only from circuit court. House Bill 3068 would expand this to allow direct appeal from municipal courts or justice courts that are a court of record.
And we'll have Alan, is it Rappelier.
Thank you, Representative.
Is Peter. It French?
It's French. Very good.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee for hearing my testimony today on House Bill 3068. For the record, my name is Alan Rappelier. That's Rappelier. I'm the city attorney for the city of Beaverton. And this is a small technical fix to the process of municipal courts and justice courts on how they can process appeal. And let me briefly just give you the history of this and how we found out this problem. A couple years ago, you may have heard of a case called Machuca versus the State of Oregon, where the Court of Appeals tossed out all the breathalyzers, basically saying they're illegal. And so, as you can imagine, that put all the hundreds of pending DUI cases at risk, including three that were in the court of at the Municipal Court in Beaverton. Those breathalyzer tests for those people were tossed out. And so the Attorney General took that Court of Appeals case and took it to the Supreme Court to try to get it reversed. And so then the interim, they had to file interlocutory appeals on all those suppressions. In our case, we had three cases that they tossed out the breathalyzer, and the state took those to the Court of Appeals because they were hoping to get it reversed at the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court did reverse that case, and so all across the state, all those other DUIs could continue now on with the admission of the breathalyzers. But the Court of Appeals, in a case called State versus Peter DeGroff, said that for municipal courts that you couldn't do that because you're not covered under the statute. And if you recall, a few years ago, you folks allowed cities like Beaverton to have courts of record, where we could have a municipal court and to make a decision just like circuit courts and have the appeals go directly to the Court of Appeals. So even though we are almost exactly the same as circuit courts under the statutes that are written, we couldn't take those interlocutory appeals and do those prosecutions just like circuit court. So again, this is just a minor technical fix that would allow us to be treated the same as them and to sort of close this loophole and allow us to prosecute those type of cases. So I'm here for any questions about the bill.
Committee members, any questions?
And again, I urge you to support the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We don't have a fiscal on this bill, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on it. We're going to skip down and open a public hearing on House Bill 3481.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3481 is a complex bill, so I'll be summarizing this more than usual. I'll ask to refer to staff measure summary. Section 1, basically this has to do with a number of different things, predominantly the victim's rights portion of the state constitution. Section 1 of House Bill 3481 expands the rights of individuals, not just victims, to challenge an order for the early production of books, papers, or documents by the court subpoena powers if the individuals have a privacy interest in the content of those documents. This would be grant those individuals the right to a hearing. At the hearing, they would be given the ability to retain an attorney, the right to present and cross-examine witnesses, and the right to present or request a protective order limiting the distribution of those documents. Section 2 modifies the level of consultation a district attorney must have with crime victims. Presently, we're required, district attorneys are required to notify the court as to whether a victim is present for the plea and to make reasonable efforts to consult the victim. This increases the amount of consultation that is necessary and requires the district attorney to consult the victim both before making a plea offer and before entering into an ultimate plea agreement. Sections 3 through 5 allow a judge to vacate a plea prior to sentencing if the trial judge's proposed disposition of the case is more lenient than the plea agreement. Basically, this would be done on motion of the district attorney, and a judge would be required to vacate the plea if there was a substantial derogation from the plea agreement in the direction of leniency. Section 6 pertains to the so-called rape shield law under Oregon Rule of Evidence 412. This section allows the admission of reputation or opinion evidence of past sexual behavior in sex assault or abuse cases. House Bill 3481 would allow a victim to appeal the admission of such evidence prior to trial upon their own motion, regardless of whether the government intended an appeal of their own. This interlocutory appeal would halt the proceedings until the result of the appeal is returned. Section 7 governs the release of police reports and other documentary evidence to victims. This expands the rights of victims to access those reports and would require the district attorney to release all materials, reports, police reports, and such as soon as practicable, both for open cases, but also for investigations that do not ultimately result in a prosecution. Section 8 clarifies that person crime, for the purposes of these the aforementioned sections, would include any person felony or person class A misdemeanor, as defined by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Section 9 allows crime victims to assert a right for speedy trial and assert a claim for violation of that right under ORS 147515, which provides for appellate review. Section 10 and 11 extend the right of victims to make a request to reconsider a release decision of a defendant or to allege a violation of the portion of the state constitution pertaining to victims' rights. Presently, such a claim needs to be made within 7 days. House Bill 3481 would expand this term to 30. There are several amendments floating around. I'll leave it to the proponents to describe those.
Steve Dole. You want to come up and bring all your people with you?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'm going to keep, I provided some written comments, so I'll keep my testimony to a minimum here. House Bill 304081 basically has to do with, as committee counsel said, procedural mechanisms to enforce privacy rights for victims regarding records. Second privacy matter is around the issue of defending their already existing rights in rape shield laws. It has to do with the issue of plea negotiations and settlement conferences and making sure that victims are heard and present. It also has to do with plea negotiations in front of a judge and ensuring that victims and the state have the same rights as the defense and defendants do. And last but not least, provides for presumption of disclosure of police reports to crime victims. One last thing is the issue of extending the time period that was passed in Senate Bill 233, which was the enabling bill for Measures 50 and 51, which was the measures that changed the Constitution and allowed victims to seek remedy when they're rights were violated. With that, I have people on a panel here that can give you more detail on the bill, the author of the bill, Doug Ballouf, and two attorneys who represent crime victims in private practice. So thank you very much. And we ask you to pass the bill.
Good morning, co-chairs Barker and Krieger, honorable committee members. My name is Doug Ballouf. I'm a professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law. Two of the provisions in this bill seek to ensure that a crime victim's already existing privacy rights are protected. Section 1 eliminates ex parte subpoenas of crime victims' records held by third parties, gives the victim notice of such subpoenas, and provides an opportunity to object to disclosure. The abuse of ex parte subpoenas is an ongoing problem, not just in Oregon, but nationally. My colleague Aaron Olson will give you a few examples of that. The problem is significant enough that the American Bar Association endorsed an amendment to the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which is similar to this section of the bill. That amendment has already been enacted, but covers only federal procedure. This section would provide the same procedural protections to crime victims in Oregon as federal procedures. Today, victims' records can be subpoenaed from third parties without court order and without notice to the victim. Thus, it's possible for private records to be subpoenaed and read without any showing by the court. The idea of giving the victims notice and an opportunity to object is to give them an opportunity to file motions to quash the subpoena should the subpoena be inappropriate. In theory, it is the hospitals and counselors who are supposed to send their lawyers to court and file motions to quash the subpoenas, but as everyone knows, sometimes a counselor can be a sole practitioner, and frequently it is simply easier to turn over the records requested by subpoena, and it is certainly cheaper to do so rather than to object to their production. On Friday on this section, the courts asked that the language concerning the records be made clearer to reflect that these are records of the victim rather than any imaginable or conceivable record that might contain the victim's name. This is a reasonable request, and we will seek to amend the bill in that fashion. Section 6 is the second procedure in this bill designed to protect the victim's privacy. It essentially gives the victim the right to participate in the Rape Shield hearing and to seek review. This, too, would bring Oregon in conformity with federal law. A federal court opinion affirmed the right of the victim to participate and to appeal, saying, quote, "While the rule makes no reference to the right of a victim to appeal an adverse ruling, nevertheless, the remedy is implicit as a necessary corollary of the rule's explicit privacy protection of the privacy interests sought to safeguard. No other party in the evidentiary proceeding shares these interests to the extent they might be viewed as a champion of the victim's rights. Therefore, the intent embodied in the Rape Shield rule will be frustrated if victims are not allowed to appeal an erroneous evidentiary ruling made at a pretrial hearing conducted pursuant to the rule. Oregon sexual assault victims are no less deserving of procedurals to protect their privacy than federal sexual assault victims." Regarding Section 2, the Oregon Constitution gives the victim the right to be consulted upon request regarding plea negotiations concerning any violent felony. However, the Oregon Constitution also takes away any remedy if that right is violated. This is because remedies for this kind of right in the Oregon Constitution are limited in that no conviction can be invalidated no matter how flagrantly victims' rights are violated. So what needs to be done is we need to create upfront procedures to minimize the possibility that victims' right to consultation will be abrogated. And we do that by creating a colloquy between the courts and the district attorney. Was the victim notified? How was the victim notified? What is their position? Did you consult with them? I understand from the courts that they are working towards engaging in such colloquies as we speak. This makes sense, as few courts would want to be put in the position of accepting a plea, sentencing the defendant, only to discover the victim was denied their right to confrontation. Sections 3, 4, and 5 correct an inequity that presently exists in plea bargain law. Currently, when the defense and prosecution reach an agreement, only the defendant can withdraw from that agreement. The defendant's withdrawal can take place if the court decides the bargain is too lenient. On the other hand, if the court decides the sentence is too harsh, the state cannot have the agreement vacated. The public interest and victim's interests are thus marginalized. This lopsided procedure means an agreement can only be undone by one party, the defendant. This bill provides the state with the same opportunity. In fairness, I have heard the criticism that this provision reduces judicial discretion. However, it is a criticism that applies with equal force to the presently existing defendant's ability to withdraw from the agreement. In that circumstance, the judge has no discretion to impose a harsher sentence that the judge deems appropriate. If the committee simply preferred to eliminate the unique treatment provided the defendant, that option, too, would put the parties on a level playing field in regards to plea agreements and is an option I would support. Section 7 is very straightforward and expands from crimes involving automobile collisions to all crimes the presumption that victims may access government reports. I've talked to the district attorneys on Friday, and they would like to make the language clearer that they can withhold the reports if the release would interfere with that investigation. This is a reasonable request, and I regret that I heard it only on Friday, but that's something we'll be correcting going forward. Finally, are sections 10 and 11, and my colleague Janine Robbins will speak to that. When we worked on Senate Bill 233, and I worked on that bill extensively, we tried to create extremely conservative time limits for victims to file claims. So it was done very consciously. And the idea was we'll start very, very conservatively and we'll see if it works. And that's the bill that came out of the legislature. As it turns out, this timeline is so restrictive that victims are, as a practical matter, unable to enforce their constitutional rights in many circumstances. As a result, the issue has become one of constitutional dimension, in that such a restrictive statutory timeline is now likely to be unconstitutional. The solution is simple: to extend the timeline. And I want to give the committee comfort that this extension of time and the victim's claim filing cannot be used to suspend any criminal proceedings. The Oregon Constitution already prohibits that. The language is, nothing in this section may be used to suspend any criminal proceedings at any point after the case is commenced. So the 30 days, while giving the victim more time to file a claim, does not stop the proceedings from going forward. Also, the recent amendments to the Oregon Constitution expressly grant the legislature, you, authority to adjust these time limits and structure them. So it's appropriate that you, rather than the courts, should do so. You have express authority to do so. Thank you, Chair Barker. Thank you, Chair Krieger, members of the committee.
My name is Erin Olson. I'm an attorney in private practice. I've done that for 7 years, and my practice exclusively focuses on the representation of crime victims. I do that both in civil and in criminal cases. Before that, I was a prosecutor for a long time, so I have an understanding of the implications of this proposed bill, both from the prosecution's standpoint and from the victim's standpoint. There are three problems that we face as victims' attorneys that are much more extensive than the other problems that are reflected in this bill. Those three problems are the issuance of subpoenas for our clients' private records, generally mental health records or medical records, without our clients' knowledge. Plea consultations that either happen belatedly or don't happen at all before a plea agreement is entered into. And the inability to obtain records from the investigation prior to the conclusion of the criminal case, if at all. In many cases, we're getting told that we're not allowed to, that the district attorneys and the law enforcement agencies aren't permitted to turn over the records at all unless there's a court order, because they're governed by DHS or some other confidentiality statute. Those are the three primary problems. Those three problems are all addressed in this legislation. The subpoenas issued for our clients' records are often extremely broad. They don't just say, we want any disclosures that would support to negate the rape report, for example. They are, we want all your clients' records for the last 10 years, all their medical and mental health treatment records. And for those of you who have had mental or medical care, you understand that you might not want all those records turned over to a criminal defendant who will have access to them. This simply gives victims the right to know that their records have been subpoenaed and the right to step in and say to the courts, we understand that you may need some of these records because there may be exculpatory evidence, but we want the court to control this process and we don't want anything overwhelmingly broad released because we know the defendant's going to get a look at it. So the first part of the bill addresses that. The plea negotiations are an ongoing problem. They have been for years. Even when there was a statutory right to consult, the statutory right was often overlooked. Judicial settlement conferences are often where settlements occur, in fact, and I have participated on behalf of clients in those conferences, and it's a very important part of the process for my client. They get to be heard by the judge who's making a recommendation as to what an appropriate settlement would be, and victims ought to have the right to be there. And finally, the records statute giving victims access to police records is simply to give them the same access that defendants have with discretion left in the district attorneys if there's a legitimate reason not to disclose them. The district attorneys can disclose under particular conditions or they can ask the court to enforce the conditions that they impose. I'm not going to talk about the rest of the changes. They're less serious in terms of what we're requesting here today, but I will say that none of these changes require a change to the Oregon Constitution, and none of them trump any rights that the criminal defendant already has. The criminal defendant's statutory and constitutional rights are not affected by this. To the extent that they are, the defendant's constitutional rights would trump any of these statutory rights.
Good afternoon. I'm Janine Robin, and I'm the legal director of the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center, speaking in support of the amendments that are contained in Sections 10 and 11. The Oregon Crime Victims Law Center was created in 2009 by former Attorney General Hardy Meyer and others in anticipation of the legislation which these sections seek to amend. We provide crime victims with no-cost legal representation in asserting and enforcing their rights under this statute. We personally have handled more than 95% of the claims made under the statute, and we are aware of the few others that have been made by other persons. Unfortunately, some claims that could have been made of violations of victims' rights were not made because they could not be made within the current 7-day statutory time period, which begins to toll when the victim knew or reasonably should have known of the triggering event. This is because it frequently takes the victim at least a day or two to learn that the triggering event, such as a sentencing that took place without his or her presence, has happened and was a rights violation, to be directed to our center or another source of legal help. Then we have to talk to the victim, we have to talk to the district attorney, try to talk to the defense attorney, everyone else who is involved in the case, and obtain documents from the court. Even though the intervening non-judicial days like weekends don't count towards the 7-day time period for the statutes, the fact that the clerks and DA's offices are closed on those days means that we still only have a maximum of 7 days to collect information and file. If the case is in the county outside of the tri-county area, we have to allot some of those 7 days to getting our documents filed within the 7-day time period. For these reasons, we're supporting amendment of this legislation to change the statutory time period from 7 days to 30 days. Thank you.
Committee members, questions?
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I just had one point of clarification. I don't know who's the most appropriate to ask. Section 1 in, and I'm speaking to the intro version here, sub 5, sub D, so motion comes out to request records. Sub D says that the victim would have the right to present evidence and cross-examine witnesses at the hearing. I'm just curious who you envision in a typical hearing of that sort the victim through counsel would be cross-examining.
I'll give you an example that resulted in a reported bar discipline. It involved an attorney who had subpoenaed my client's records from a school. The hearing was in front of Judge Noctegal in Washington County, and I cross-examined the criminal defense attorney who had handed a bunch of blank subpoenas to his investigator, who then served them with the instructions to dig up dirt on the victim. I cross-examined the criminal defense attorney, his legal investigator, as well as the school custodian who'd released the records. The prosecutor also cross-examined those witnesses, and after an hour and a half or two-hour hearing, Judge Noctegal ordered the records all returned and sealed the affidavit that was submitted in support of those. The significance in that case was that the records from the school contained mental health treatment records, medical records, and other records that were then used to go get DHS records on the victim, and those DHS records contained extraordinarily personal information about the victim. So that's a practical answer to your question.
Thank you.
Aaron, the dash ones, are they a total rewrite?
Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, no, I don't perceive that the dash one amendments are a total rewrite. They seem to orient themselves predominantly to section one, which is the record request. There's also some modification being made to the definition section at section eight, and then the addition, I believe, of section 12. I might ask proponents to comment on the dash one with the leave.
What we ran into, Chair Krieger, when we had the first draft of section one, was we ran into the fact that we may be conflicting with existing law on the confidentiality of medical records. So most of this amendment is to coordinate between those laws that govern medical records and their release in this bill. There is also a change to expand the definition of who could represent a victim to include guardians ad litem and conservators of estates. Section 12 in the amendment is also part of that effort to coordinate pre-existing medical records law with this bill.
Okay. Anything further, committee? Okay, thank you. We have Elizabeth Courgeois, Christine Herman, and Doug Hackerod. Come up, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Courgeois for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We have moved from being opposed to the original bill to being neutral in the bill in its amended form. We have one consideration for Section 7, which had allowed for the release of all records to victims or survivors. Part of this included the fact that the survivor may also be the suspect. We were concerned about that. We were concerned about if the victim is a child, and the parent is also defined as a victim under statute in that case. The parent could ask for the records to impede the prosecution, so we were concerned. The proponents have been kind enough to entertain another amendment to clarify that the district attorney does not have to give over the reports in those instances. If we see language at the end that meets our concerns, we can move from opposition to neutral to support. So that's where we are at this time. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to ask.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force. I'm just here to add my support to House Bill 3481, in particular two sections that have the greatest impact on sexual assault victims. The first is Section 1 regarding the subpoena process of personal records. And I would like to add that my experience prior to coming to Oregon was as a prosecutor in Washington, and during that time I concentrated primarily on sex crimes. There was a change in case law during my time up there that would require the same sort of notice that's inside House Bill 3481. And I was able to see the difference once there was a requirement of notice for the victims before personal records were released, and it made a huge difference to victims. One of the things that we hear again and again is that people are afraid to report sexual assault because of the concerns about the invasion of their personal privacy. We see things on the news, we hear things on TV about what happens to rape victims when they report. The protections included in Sections 1 and then in Section 6 regarding the right to be heard and present at a Rape Shield hearing will have a direct impact on how that's perceived, or the risks that are perceived by sexual assault victims of reporting and trusting the criminal justice system to actually be just for them. Section 6 that allows for the rape victim to be heard and present at the Rape Shield hearing, I believe that Professor Ballouf explained this so succinctly that there's not much I can add. I would just say again that this is an important thing, an important protection for rape victims, and without it, the protections of victim rights are really meaningless. That there's no opportunity to be present and heard, and then there's no opportunity to contest a finding, then the rights are actually pointless. So I thank the proponents for this bill and I encourage the committee to pass it.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney and I currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports this bill with the amendments and with the most recent comments of Ms. Kushwa. I'd like to put this bill in a little bit of context, if I could. I took office in 1985 in Lane County. Victims had no rights. Victims had no rights. We got our first measure giving them rights in 1986 by the voters passing it. Bob and Dee Dee Coons were instrumental. I participated. We started a victim services program in Lane County. Victims have, over time, a combination of the people voting and a combination of the legislature voting to increase the rights of victims in the criminal justice system. At some point, I think we could go too far. This bill does not go too far. It helps victims in a variety of ways, only one of which do I want to cover today very quickly. Most in the room will recall when Kip Kinkle shot his parents, killed two students at Thurston High School, and wounded 26 others. I was there as the first lawyer on that scene. I remember it distinctly. When it came time to finally resolve that case or try to resolve that case, we could have resolved that case before victims' rights had really taken hold without ever talking to the victims. What a foolish thing that would have been, and we, of course, did not do that. We created a special victims' room because 26 children were wounded, and so you can imagine the number of parents that wanted to participate. We started a two-day settlement conference, and the first thing I basically told Judge Brewer then down from the Court of Appeals was, we'll work on this, but this case will not be settled without the approval of these victims, and we need to talk to them, but I'm not going to go talk to them until I think we've got a tentative settlement. Long and short of it, we got that settlement. The victims were well protected, but they need to be protected in law, and they were not protected in law then. They were just protected because prosecutors, myself then, and in general around this state, do the best they possibly can to protect those victims. So I support this bill.
Members? Guess I could let you off easy. Thank you. Andrea Meyer, Gail Meyer, Sean Wiley, and Meredith Allen.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to House Bill 3481. I'm going to let the folks near me, the practitioners, speak to more of the specifics. I just wanted to comment because this is an issue to which ACLU and others over the years have been part of the process. And back in 2007, when, as I recall, it was Pete Shepard in the Attorney General's office, worked with folks to bring the referrals back to the voters on the constitutional amendments, ACLU was, if not neutral, actually somewhat supportive. It made two important changes and that we thought and continue to think are important. One is the issue of providing notification to victims. And the other piece that had been lacking was, at that time, the DA determined who the victim was. And this allowed a process where if there was a question about that, the victim could seek remedy in court if the DA had not determined that they were the victim or a victim. The result was that the Oregon voters passed the two amendments to the Constitution, Sections 42 and 43 of Article 1. And as a result of that was a large work group, very large work group, and I think it met many times. And I learned that different folks have different positions, and as you all know, DAs are elected, and they may always not have the same position. So there was a lot of work that went into that. And that is reflected in Senate Bill 233 that was passed, I always want to say last session, but can't do that anymore, in 2009. This has just come into effect ostensibly. It has only been a while. This has significant processes and procedures. And one of our concerns and our cautions is moving forward with yet new additions without having had the time to make sure this system works. You'll note in section, well, sorry, it's in the statute somewhere. I just brought the bill in. In section 20 of the 2009 legislation, the work group and the decision contemplated was actually to create a task force where the AG would appoint members and review a number of aspects of how this was working. And my reading of this was to present a report no later to you all on January 1, 2011. It is not January 1, 2011, and we've not seen a report, and I know others can speak to their request of trying to get that report. We need that information. More importantly, to some of the substantive, and again, I will let my colleagues go into it, but we just begin to be very concerned about undermining the rights of the defendant in the criminal justice system and altering the criminal justice system in terms of how it works. We have a delicate balance in Oregon with the expansion of victims' rights, and we believe that is the process that should move forward and not some additional changes. And with that, I'll let others speak more specifically to the bill.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Oregon really has cause to be very proud of what it does to protect victims' rights. It's flush with constitutional provisions, statutory provisions, and now quasi-administrative provisions that are designed to protect victims' rights as they interface with the criminal justice system. We acknowledge the rights of crime victims to have notice of proceedings before they occur. We acknowledge their rights to have information about the proceedings, about their rights under the statutes of the Constitution, and also information about the accused himself, him or herself. We acknowledge their right to be present and to be heard at proceedings like release decisions and trial and sentencing, and the right to be consulted before a plea agreement is finally reached between the state and the accused. And we also acknowledge the right to be heard at the time of sentencing. Now, primarily, we've always looked to the district attorney and their offices, their staff, to implement these rights. And to some extent, there's been a bit of a tension between the district attorney's role in representing the interests of the state of Oregon, but they have been the conduit through which a lot of these rights have been conveyed to the victim and through which the victim has also communicated their rights. Crime victims, of course, are entitled to show up at these proceedings with their own attorneys, and they are doing so more and more and more. I'll get back to that in a moment. And again, in being flush with this infrastructure that does protect crime victims' rights, we now have this task force that's been in place since 2009 in the Attorney General's office. I know I've made requests of someone there to be present today. They're not. I know that they've undertaken a survey of crime victims to get their input on how their rights have been enforced. They have within the task force a compliance review process. So any complaints from crime victims about how these proceedings have unfolded can be given to the Attorney General's office. None of them to date have been so egregious that it's resulted in a formal process review. There is a report that's due January 1. It has not been published. But one of the charges of the task force is to propose more legislation. So what I note here is that the proponents are proceeding forward with more legislation, and yet it's the task force which has been charged with the responsibility of undertaking that work. So I guess the question is really, what's missing? What is Oregon not doing? And I would submit to the committee, we're not doing nothing. We're doing everything. What is different about this bill, and some of it is hidden within provisions that have not yet been discussed by the proponents, is that it decouples crime victims' rights from the prosecutor's position of having to decide what is best for the state of Oregon. And it now positions crime victims through their independent attorneys to have some rights in these provisions, which are autonomous and almost akin to third-party rights. That's what is so different about this bill from the other ones that we've previously addressed. I have two witnesses to my left, your right, who will be addressing other parts. This is a Christmas tree bill. There's a lot of different little provisions here. But I would like to address two of them. And again, typically, we have looked to the district attorneys to be the gatekeeper. What really is in the best interest for the state of Oregon? They take into consideration the victim's perspective, interests, points of view, but it is their responsibility to make ultimately the decision of what's in best for the state of Oregon. If you look at the bill, 3481, Section 9 on page 7, Section 9 just simply has a little bit of bold text. It just inserts ORS 147-430. It looks really simple, but the net effect of this is actually quite profound. 147-430 is the statutory rights of a crime victim for a speedy trial. This was implemented in 2009. In 2009, I remember being in front of this committee, there was a bill that said crime victims have the right to have the trial occur with all due practicable speed, and the same thing with their appellate remedies. And yet the bill, as it was introduced in 2009, had no teeth. There was no enforcement mechanism. And I was concerned at the time that it would ultimately result in appellate review of a denial of a speedy trial setting, but was assured, no, this is really simply, we simply want the victim to come forward, have a conversation with the trial judge. I need this trial to occur quickly. Well, what Section 9 now does is that it does put that statutory provision, that speedy right provision, in the context where it can now result in direct appellate review to the Supreme Court, bypassing the Court of Appeals. I point this out for a reason. Proponents intentionally decoupled their right from the remedy, because they think that they knew that if they had coupled the right with the remedy of direct appellate review to the Supreme Court, it would have been too much, and this committee would have exercised cause in passing the bill. But by decoupling it, it seemed innocuous, and now a little one-liner, it puts them in a position now where they do have direct appellate rights to the Supreme Court on the setting of a trial date. That is akin to a third-party right. It's the parties who have the right to be heard as to the setting of the trial date, and it's the interests of their cases that need to be considered. But this would effectually put crime victims in the rights of a third party with appellate review of that setting. I also want to look at Section 1. There's been some discussion about this, the defendant's right to access records prior to trial. We've had discussions before this committee already, more specifically with respect to the bills that would have eliminated the statute of limitations on certain sex crimes against minors. How throughout time statute of limitation periods that have been extended at the same time the defendant's ability to have access to relevant information and documents has been more and more curtailed. This and it happens incrementally. But what happens here is the defendant does not have the right to just go out and issue subpoenas for records that they think are relevant. They have to go to the court and ask for permission, and they have to lay out their case theory. This is why these records are important. The court authorizes them to issue a subpoena. The court then takes the records, if they're sensitive and privileged, and reviews them in camera and decides what part of those records the defense is entitled to have. This would require two hearings rather than one, a hearing in advance to decide whether the subpoena should issue. But this is what's radically different. On page 3 of the -1 amendment, it would allow the crime victims the right to present evidence and to cross-examine witnesses at the hearing. And that is what radically is new. We have always, to date, acknowledged that it's the crime victims who... They're not parties, and it's parties who have the right of cross-examination and the right to present evidence. And we question where else that right will be extended in future bills. I do note for the committee, I think the committee is aware of this, retired Justice Mick Gillette is making an effort to be here this afternoon to talk about this bill to the committee. I know that he is en route, and it does not seem to me likely that he will be here right following our testimony, so it may be that we might have to ask for courtesies for a little bit of suspension until he does arrive. Thank you.
My name is Meredith Allen, and I work for the Office of Public Defense Services, the Appellate Division, and we handle the appeals for criminal defendants either after their conviction or when the state pursues a pretrial appeal. I'm here to address Section 6, which modifies OEC 412, the evidence rule regarding sexual behavior of the victims. And that rule in general excludes sexual behavior evidence, and when a defendant wants such evidence admitted, there's a very strict notice and protected hearing requirement for a defendant to be able to get that evidence in. What Section 6 would do would be to allow the victim, in addition to the government, the prosecution, the right to pursue an interlocutory or pretrial appeal, and I'm urging the committee not to include that section in whatever passes. In my experience, and I've had both appellate and trial experience, this rule works well. The most usual outcome of this hearing is to exclude sexual behavior evidence. And when the court does admit the evidence, it's usually for a really good reason, and that's because the court, as a matter of law, must admit the evidence. The rule includes in it a list of legal reasons why the court must admit certain evidence. And I've included in my written testimony, which you will get a copy of, and I'll go over now, some examples of situations when evidence must be admitted. And the point here is that a victim appealing this is not going to change that outcome. All it's going to do is delay the prosecution, which is not an outcome that anybody really wants. So the court must admit the evidence when it relates to the motive or bias. That's always going to be relevant and admissible evidence. It's going to be important to the truth-seeking function of a trial. It's admissible to rebut or explain scientific or medical evidence admitted by the state, and it's admitted when the evidence is constitutionally required to be admitted, and that's the rule is there. That's when the evidence is particularly exculpatory when weighed against the victim's interests in seeking exclusion. So there's already a strong consideration for the victim's interests in the rule, and all that these additional appeal rights are going to do is delay the prosecution. Some specific examples of when the court must admit the evidence, and that's when the victim claims, perhaps, that she knew the defendant only as a friend. The defendant can introduce evidence that their relationship was otherwise. Clearly, that's evidence that a jury needs to hear in a trial. Another example, when the state introduces and primarily relies on evidence that the victim's physical exam revealed physical evidence of a sexual assault, the defendant can introduce evidence that the victim had previously been sexually assaulted, and so there's another source for that physical evidence other than the defendant's acts. This is the kind of evidence that a defendant needs to be able to admit, and the court is going to have to allow the defendant to admit. In those rare circumstances, this appeal isn't going to go anywhere, and it's just going to delay the prosecution. Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Wiley. I'm a Chief Deputy Defender at the Appellate Division of the Office of Public Defense Services, which is a long way of saying I represent criminal defendants on appeal. Thank you for the opportunity to testify concerning House Bill 3481. My testimony will be limited to Sections 3, 4, and 5 of the bill. Unlike other sections of the bill, Sections 3, 4, and 5 do not concern a right held by the victim of a crime. Instead, that portion would confer on the district attorney the right to have the trial court vacate a guilty plea by the defendant that was previously accepted by the court. Such a provision, if enacted, would violate the defendant's constitutional rights under the Oregon and United States Constitution, and those are double jeopardy rights. As currently worded, the key statute at issue, which is ORS 135432, contemplates that when the prosecution and the defense reach a tentative plea agreement, they can share those details with the court. The court then can give a preliminary indication of whether or not it will accept and impose the recommended sentence or disposition. That determination is not final, however. After the plea, the court is free to not impose the agreed upon disposition and go a different route. The statute as currently worded allows the defendant to withdraw his plea under those circumstances. The bill before you, House Bill 3481, purports to level the playing field, so to speak, by giving the DA the same right. The problem is that forcing a defendant to withdraw a previously accepted guilty plea or vacating that plea violates the defendant's double jeopardy rights. And that's because jeopardy attaches when the court accepts a defendant's guilty plea. In essence, the defendant has been convicted right there and then. A defendant can waive those rights, such as when he or she avails him or herself of the procedures that are outlined in the current statute. In other words, if the court allows a defendant to withdraw a plea, the defendant then takes advantage of that and withdraws the plea, he or she has essentially waived double jeopardy rights. But those rights exist upon acceptance of the plea. And I provided case law support for that proposition in the written testimony that I provided the committee. The rule recognizes that a defendant has been convicted upon the acceptance of a guilty plea. Allowing the DA to undo that plea and conviction would be the same as a situation in which the defendant chooses to go to trial and is convicted by a jury, then proceeds to sentencing and the DA doesn't like the sentence that was received or imposed by the court, and wants to retry the case. The procedural posture is the exact same. The defendant has been convicted upon pleading guilty, and the court can proceed to sentencing at that point. The rule also recognizes that for purposes of plea bargaining, the defendant has performed his or her part of the agreement by pleading guilty. That is the bargaining chip that the defendant has. In other words, the defendant agrees to plead guilty in exchange for concessions made by the state. So at the time the court accepts the plea, the defendant's done his part of the bargain. Thank you very much.
Committee members, any questions? Well, come on, our attorneys are so quiet today. Representative Schaffer?
Well, if they ain't saying anything, I ain't saying anything.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we had signed up, I believe, on that bill. Except for Justice Gillette, and he's not here. If he does come before we're done, we'll probably open back up, but we'll close the hearing now on House Bill 3481. Wilson. Committee, stand at ease for a few minutes. Wait for Mr. Taylor. open a public hearing on House Bill 3309.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3309 comes from Representative Barker, Washington County, requires the Department of Corrections to create an on-the-job training program for offenders released back in the community from the Department of Corrections, requires the Department to provide grants to counties who administer the training program. As chair, members of the committee, we have a fiscal impact statement from last week, which shows a $1 to $1.8 billion fiscal. You may remember there was a discussion about this last Friday. We're concerned that this is a different viewpoint than what the Department of Corrections has. I've spoken with the Legislative Fiscal's Office again today. They say it has definitely the potential for that, that it does not appear to be discretionary with the agency in their viewpoint, and therefore they're suggesting that the bill is not the Ways and Means because of the fiscal.
Okay. And it's ready to move to Ways and Means.
Chair, members of the committee, you have the bill in front of you. There's no amendments. We have the fiscal. We have the revenue. So it has all the paperwork ready to do.
Ways and Means. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Bill 3309 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. There is a dash one amendment on 3309.
Oh.
So my apologies for interruption.
There's still a fiscal, Mr. Chairman. So the amendments, the fiscal I had was the dash one.
Okay.
So move the dash one.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to 3309.
Representative Hicks moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3309. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just so we know what we're moving.
Yes, sir.
Ma'am. Can we have 2 seconds to look at the dash one?
Okay.
Okay.
Any no objection?
Very dense order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3309 with the dash one amendments to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves House Bill 3309 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm willing to join in the recommendation of the committee as long as the committee does not think that there's a pot of gold sitting in the Ways and Means Committee to cover expenses like this one. But we will take this committee's considered opinion into account. But yeah, we still have to balance the public safety budget.
I understand that,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Indeed. And I think it's worth moving it into the Ways and Means process, if only to delve into that fiscal question a bit more, because I do consider it still open-ended. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Bolton? Aye. Representative Salford?
Aye.
Representative Clement? Aye. Representative Warren?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries and moved to Ways and Means. Is there any further business? We adjourn.